Greet you again in Jesus' name. So I think some of what Joshua was saying was that there's more and more and more here, and we've only had a few sessions here. And I would like for you to remember, long after these sessions are over, that you can all keep going back to endless treasures in here. And my prayer is that somehow, something, maybe not even new, something prompted you to read again and read more. Thank you, brothers and sisters here, for your hospitality. And for, I got the little photo album of pictures of all of you. That helps a lot. Enjoy that. And brother gave me a gift of a piece of framed art. Thank you for that, the meals. And now I have some places and a mental image of Pensacola to take home to Missouri. And you haven't been to see brothers and sisters at Missouri, you need to do so. It's not very far north of here. And we are, I believe, as you are, we are trying. We're also trying there. So. All right. I will try to not tax your endurance. But I have a little bit, one more mini lesson on worshiping God. Thought of skipping it, but I thought, no, it wouldn't be fair. We had six, so we're going to do all six. So, children, maybe you've seen a painting of Da Vinci's Last Supper, and all the disciples are ranged up behind this table, and there's Jesus, and there's people leaning around, there's food on the table, and we call that the Last Supper. And one of the things you do in worship sometimes is that we have a special service where the deaconess and the deacon, they bring, I don't know how you do it here, I don't know how you do communion, but somehow you have a plate with some bread, pieces of bread on it, and you have some glasses or cups of grape juice, and the adults come up and they take a little bit of it, maybe they go back to their seats, I don't know how you do it here. And it all seems a little mysterious, doesn't it? You're a little child. Try to see and to see what Father has in his hand. I don't know how you do it here. But there's that moment where everyone is eating a little bit of bread. And you're a little child. You look around. You wonder about that. What's going on here? Well, when Jesus had Passover supper with his disciples, right before he was crucified, it was a regular Passover, right? It was a regular Passover. They had unleavened bread, and they had different dishes on there, like a Passover, some cup of wine to pass around. But what was different this time, not other Passovers, Jesus said some different things. When they had the bread, he said, now take some of this. Well, first of all, he thanked God for it, so he gave thanks. Then he said, now take a little piece of this. Well, that wasn't so odd. Then he said, this is like a little piece of my body, which is going to be broken, given for you. And the disciples go, what? What? What's going on? Didn't quite make sense. And then the ritual cup of wine at the Passover meal. And he said, take a little bit, everyone, pass it around. And he said, this is my New Testament in the blood. What? What are you talking about? Disciples didn't quite understand, it seems like. And but at the end of it, what was really interesting is he said, disciples, don't ever stop doing this. As long as you live, you keep getting together, and from time to time you break little pieces of bread and you think about my death, and you take a little sip of grape juice and you think about my sacrifice. Keep doing that. 2,000 years later, here, men and women here in Pensacola, Florida, they keep on breaking little pieces of bread and passing around grape juice and so on. And that's kind of amazing, isn't it? Maybe your deaconess, I don't know how you do it. You buy the bread, you make the bread. How do you do that here? That's different places. But do you eat bread that's made out of an ordinary sack of flour? Assume you start with some flour. Who makes the bread here? Anyone? You buy it, okay? You start with regular flour. Okay, so yeah, flour, which is, comes from wheat in the fields. Now, you don't have to have unleavened bread. Jesus didn't say so, although we're pretty sure Jesus and the disciples had unleavened bread. That's good enough for me if it was good for Jesus. There's people that don't use unleavened bread, and I'm not going to judge them because Jesus didn't. But in Jesus' day, they would go out and they'd gather grapes and they would trod on them or squeeze the juice out of them. Grape juice was nice, but it spoiled quickly, right? So the only thing, the way to keep the grape juice was to let it ferment. Through a fermentation process, you make wine. Well, once it's wine, it keeps for years in a cool place. It's a good way to keep the grape juice, but it also has a little chemical in called alcohol, right? And alcohol makes people do irrational things if they get too much. So this is a little bit of a problem. So if you're going to have communion at a time when there's no grapes growing, there's no fresh grape juice, what are you going to do? There isn't any. There's any before times where they could freeze it or something like that. And so in 1869, there was a Methodist minister in New Jersey. Thomas Welch was his name, and he was Methodist. And Methodists have very strict rules, even more than Mennonites traditionally. But one of the rules they had is no alcoholic grape juice in communion. Absolutely not. And he's bothered by this. There's got to be a way to figure this out. And he invented a way to pasteurize grape juice, kind of like you do milk. You heat it and so forth. And if you pasteurize it right, you put grape juice in a bottle and it keeps for a long time. And sure enough, you can go out to the supermarket right now. You can buy Welch's grape juice. Maybe you use Welch's grape juice for communion here. I don't know what you use. That's the story behind it, children. So that's kind of nice. Now, Christians since the time of Jesus have tended to make a mistake about this little bread and grape juice participation activity. They've tended to err toward the side of thinking that it was like taking some Tylenol when you have a headache or some Pepto-Bismol, or when you're sick or something's wrong with you. If you take a little bit of this, you take it and now you're all better. Like it was a little medicine for your soul. And that's an error that the church slipped into. And we know in times of Reformation, revival times, like 15, 1600s, one of the things that they said, no, we can't do that. That's not how Jesus said. Jesus said that when you get together, you should do this in remembrance of me. But that's not all, that's all he said. Just do it. And do it. It won't save you, but it's not optional either. Because Jesus said, this do in remembrance of me. And Paul talked about it more too. So if you're a Christian and you don't participate in communion, then you're not honoring God's sacrifice. I think that's the teaching of the Bible. So it's very important to participate in this activity of taking the bread and the wine sometimes. So when you get older, children, and you're maybe a member of you're a Christian and you want to participate with the others and you get some bread and some of the grape juice, then you should be glad. Communion is often pretty serious, and it is. It's a serious thing happened here. But it's also a time of joy that, look, what I can receive this and think about what Jesus did for me. That's the end of my mini lesson on elements of worship. There are a few more we didn't get time to talk about, things we could do. But it's late enough on Sunday afternoon. Let's sing a little bit of our theme song one more time here. How about we do, well, it's not nighttime. How about we sing 3, 4, and 5 in rounds. Bass, you start out, soprano, tenor, alto. So 3, 4, and 5, teach me to live. Bass, oh, teach me to live, teach me to live, teach me to live. My bed.
Teach me to live that soul I never ask as
I'm going to look at a story in Luke for a final sermon here. Luke 23. The most famous executions in all of human history took place on a hill 2,000 years ago, where there were three men, rather beaten up men, were suspended on posts in a public place, and they were almost dead, but not quite. Because they were talking. They were talking among themselves. Some last words. We often note, of course, the last words of people that we love, or famous people. What were their last words? Condemned criminals sometimes have been given an opportunity. What do you have to say before a death, before an execution? They didn't particularly give this to these men, but we do know their last words. Luke 23, let's read the story. Let's start in at about 38. Certainly more before this, but we'll start in at 38. Jesus is on the cross. And a superscription also was written over him in letters of Greek and Latin and Hebrew. This is the King of the Jews. And one of the malefactors which were hanged railed on him, saying, If thou be Christ, save thyself and us. The other answering rebuked him, saying, Dost not thou fear God, seeing thou art in the same condemnation? We indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds, but this man hath done nothing amiss. And he said unto Jesus, Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. And Jesus said unto him, Verily, I say unto thee, today shalt thou be with me in paradise. And it was about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour. The sun was darkened, and the veil of the temple was rent in the midst. And when Jesus had cried with a loud voice, he said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. Having said thus, he gave up the ghost. Now when the centurion saw what was done, he glorified God, saying, Certainly, this was a righteous man. There's much here. I'll make some observations. In moments of extreme need, sometimes unbelievers still attack their rescuers. It's a pitiful state of the human family, of course. It's a kind of blindness that is hard to reconcile. But we will sometimes bite the hand stretched out to save us from deadly predicaments. I mean, this thief was seriously out of options here. He was trussed up by Roman soldiers, a common criminal, gasping at last. He didn't expect any kind of Hollywood rescue where somebody comes in at the last minute and something just happens and he just just escaped. He wasn't looking for anything like that. The Romans knew how to kill people, and they didn't do a careless job of it. And so what he was up against, it's not rational. It's not rational to do what he did, this unbelieving thief. This first one, it says he railed on Jesus. Part of training for lifeguards, water rescue, is to teach them how to deal with a victim's panic, right? So you try to rescue someone out of the water, they panic and they'll interfere with the rescue operation. They might cling to you in detracted ways where you can't do what you need to do. And one of the things they teach you is how to calm the victim down so that you can take them to land. And sometimes they have to be subdued because they're really out of control. And you don't think about a lifeguard dealing with a panicking, drowning person and saying, "Now stop it. You want me to rescue you or not? You want me just to leave you here?" No, they have ways in which they try to help them understand their intentions. If you find something like a raccoon, let's say, in a foot trap, and you move in to help the raccoon get his foot out of the trap, I don't know if you have experience with this kind of thing, but is it normal for the raccoon to say, "Oh, I'm so glad you're here," and just calm down and let you take his paw out of the trap? No. He'll bite you. Bite you. Jesus was fully aware of the petty envy of the Pharisees, the ugly greed in the scribes, whoever else says they were sitting on there watching Jesus on the cross, the heartless politics of Pilate and all the little pettiness between the Jews and the Romans. And what's interesting, it's not quoted here, but we know it was some, and where else would Jesus said this, but in Jesus' final moments of agony, he was willing to extend the benefit of ignorance to the people killing him. He said, "Father, forgive them. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And that's an incredible prayer that echoes down through time, wherever people have been in distress, wherever mankind is in a bad fix, on the streets of San Francisco or in the prisons and courtrooms, maybe in our own orderly and respectable homes where people resist and they fight the rescue. And yet so quickly, we're sure about the motives of my brother and my sister and my employee and my boss. We know they know what they're doing. We know they know what they're doing. The challenge is whether we can extend grace like Jesus and say, "They probably don't know what they're doing." You know, that's easy to stand up here and say. It's very, very hard to do. Because somehow it's very easy to look at what your sister or brother are doing and you, "Yeah, they know better. They know better." Now, did Jesus know better or not? Did Jesus know what was in the hearts of every person? Why did he pray to his Father, "Forgive them, Father, for they don't know what they're doing to me here on the cross"? Well, I think to some sense it was literally true, right? I mean, Jesus looked and he said, if all of you all would know what you're doing to me, you wouldn't do it. But anyway, this perishing unbeliever, this unbelieving criminal, was ready to blaspheme the King of Kings. It says he railed on him. That the Greek word there is blasphemeo. So this is serious. This is heavy language. Okay, and he was taunting. "If you're the Christos, if you're the anointed king, why don't you get us out of this scrape?" I mean, it was a very taunting kind of accusation. I don't know how far he could look over. I don't know how he was tied up on the cross. It says he was beside Jesus. And he says this to Jesus, and I don't know if Jesus could turn his head to look over and receive it. It doesn't seem that Jesus said anything in response. And yet, oh, we wouldn't blaspheme. That sounds pretty bad. Blaspheme. But you know how Jesus actually comes to help us a lot of times. He comes to help us through somebody that's friends to us. And they try to help us. And it's pretty easy to rail on them because they're not Jesus, right? They're spotty people. Well, the second thing I see here in the story is that salvation begins with an acknowledgement of guilt and the justness of the death penalty. So enter the second thief, the second criminal here, verse 40. What does he say? He turns and he looks. I don't know if he could see across Jesus because he was flanked left and right. Could see across. And he turns over at that statement to the other thief. And he says, you ought to be quiet. The sense I get there is what you hear sometimes in, I don't know, this is maybe Southern, but you shut your mouth, right? You don't talk like that. You're going to get trouble. And then he says something very interesting. Do you not fear God, seeing you are in the same condemnation? This man is innocent, but we're not innocent. And right in about there is where you see the salvation of the righteous thief starting to happen. Right there, when he says, I'm not innocent. I deserve to be up here on this post and to choke to death. That's me. And God had set in the Old Testament very clear penalties of murder and adultery and sodomy and witchcraft and profaning of the holy things. There was a list of things in the Old Testament. You do that, death penalty. And here is a dying man, and he says, I am guilty of, I deserve to die. And it's interesting how that in the Old Testament, Isaiah, he said that he's going to be buried. He's going to be in death with the wicked criminals. And so the final touch of shame, the King of Kings was to be crucified left and right, like mugshot lineups, you know, a row of bad people, naked, up on a post with just ordinary street thug felons on either side and a big sign on top that said, this is the King of Kings. And here, I guess, are his royal courtiers. You know, these are his cabinet, I suppose, of this king. He made his grave with the wicked. Well, the righteous thief says, don't talk like that. We deserve to die. And then let's look at the next verse. He says something more. So he gets done talking to the other thief, and then he turns to Jesus, and he addresses him, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. It's an echo of Joseph in the prison thousands of years earlier. Hey, when you get out, say something about me. I'm a prisoner. You remember me when you get out? Remember me when you come into your kingdom. It's a posture of humility. Supplication, and not a demand, but a posture of humility. Now, it's the most outrageous request, too, because he could see that Jesus was physically almost dead. And he says, when you come into your kingdom, you know, do something for me. And so that tells us that the righteous thief here saw clearly what the Pharisees and everybody else missed, maybe even the disciples, not sure. That this man was not going to die and decompose in a grave. He wasn't going to. There was going to be a kingdom. And he understood that somehow in some flash of insight or some flash of maybe the salvation of this righteous thief happened between the time he got hung up there and he said this. Like maybe just in the previous few minutes, he all of a sudden realized how this was all coming about. And he said, Jesus, you come into your kingdom. I love to sing the song, the chorus, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. It's the theme song of anybody who has seen their unworthiness and God's mercy and sees the other side of the grave. Well, what does Jesus say? Verse 43, Jesus grants pardon to people who call for help. Today, you will be with me in paradise. Now, this is up to now the first thing Jesus says on the cross at this point. With the crosstalk of the thief left and right, they were saying things. And so Jesus now talks for the first time. And he says, today you will be with me in paradise. And he was looking at the righteous thief, right? He wasn't saying in general, all ye who are observing me die today, you will be with me in paradise. He wasn't looking at the thief who was railing at him. He turned his head as best he could with a crown of thorns on. And he said, I understand, you're going to be with me in paradise. And there's some question, perhaps. Sometimes we wonder what paradise was. The word literally means a sort of enchanted garden, okay? But it wasn't some fantasy land. We know, for example, the one indication that we get into what is paradise, where is paradise, is the story of, I won't turn to it, but the story of Lazarus. It says Lazarus, the poor man, he was a beggar and then he died. And it says that who took him to paradise? Anybody know? Angels took him to paradise. But paradise wasn't quite yet heaven, okay? It wasn't in the resurrection yet. It was a place of what was Lazarus doing there? Oh, he was with Abraham, and he was resting, and he had lots of water to drink, right? Because the rich man was saying, please, a drop, just a little bit. And the answer is, no, you had all you needed. He's taking his ease now. That's a place of ease and rest. But it is a garden, paradise. I find that a pleasant idea. If you like gardens and you like, maybe it's a beautiful botanical garden, water, and I don't know. You let your imagination run. But I believe that the word paradise, as is in the scripture here, is not some kind of accident. Like I can imagine resting in a beautiful garden if that's what we have to rest in for maybe 3 years or 3 months or who knows what your time is. But Paul clarifies it in Thessalonians. You remember, he said, now let's not be confused about them which sleep, because they're going to rise to the general resurrection out of paradise. And the thief, Jesus, is not particularly in paradise, although Jesus is everywhere. But the dead, the blessed dead, rest in paradise. And the one thief, we know at least, is there. In medieval Christian traditions, it was a custom that as body of the deceased, the casket was carried out of the church, the funeral service, out to the adjoining cemetery for the burial, they would sing this text, this idea from the story of Lazarus. It was called In Paradisum, and the English translation goes something like this, a song they would sing. May the angels lead you into paradise. May the martyrs receive you at your arrival and lead you into the holy city, Jerusalem. May choirs of angels receive you, and with Lazarus, once a poor man, may you have eternal rest. Now, I don't know if that's all strictly scriptural, but I find that a beautiful text to think about, because we know the scriptural parts are angels are involved in taking us to paradise, and it's a place of rest, and martyrs are going to be there, most certainly. Was the righteous thief a martyr? For a little bit, right? Did he die for living right? No, he died for living wrong. But he was sort of a righteous man at his expiration. And so martyrs there, yes. Angels there, yes. Lazarus is there, yes. A place of rest. The text was most famously set to music in the 19th century sometime by Gabriel Fauré, and whose parents had died, and he was struggling to accept their sudden death. He just couldn't accept it. And so he worked through the process of his grief by writing this piece of music that they could sing this song about paradise for. And the result is matchless. I would love to have it sung at my funeral, I guess, but I don't know. Don't worry about that just yet. But well, in conclusion, both thieves, did you notice that? Both thieves asked for help, didn't they? Left and right, they both asked Jesus for help. One said, why don't you get, Why don't you get us out of this scrape, Jesus, King Man? Get us out of this. And the other said, please remember me. And Jesus answered the one, well, he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. To him that overcomes will I give to eat of the tree of life, which is where? In the midst of the paradise of God. That's the ultimate question we have to answer. I'm going to sing one more invitation verse, because you could be one or the other thief. You could be. And you could as simply as say, Jesus, remember me. Can you remember me when you come to your kingdom? Let's sing.